What does anarchism have to offer to anti-poverty struggles, such as the right to housing or social assistance? To find out, we spoke with PJ Lilly. PJ is an anarchist who lives and organizes in Toronto. Among her many activities, she's a member of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, and helped found the Tao Communications Network.
Start out with just a broad overview of what OCAP is and who we are. We've been based in Toronto for about 10 years, and there's a lot of other groups that we work in solidarity with, again, doing similar kind of anti-poverty, direct action, case-based kind of work across the province. But according to our zine here, I'll read that, because that's the quickest way of covering what we do right off the top. We fight for the right of poor people using direct action. That's really central, and that's kind of an anarchist fundamental, too. So it's why maybe there's some overlap between the anarchist movement and OCAP. We bring the poor, unemployed, and homeless together to defend one another and organize to fight back against the powers that attack the poor. We are critical of symbolic gestures and protests or negotiating without action. So to us, it's really results-based sort of thing, like direct action gets the goods. So we want to see, we only gauge winning by what it is that's tangible that we've won for people. So it's not really like critical sort of, we are here to protest the government. We're here to resist and effectively win something from them. We also fight, of course, like all authority in that. In that sense, that's also anarchist. Landlords, bosses, wherever we come up against, you know, institutions or those who profit from our poverty, then we're on the attack. And they recognize that OCAP is a class war. Basically a class war organization. So they do try very hard to marginalize and attack OCAP as well. And the poor in general in Toronto have had a rough ride of it since Mike Harris in 95. We confront these organizations with disruption, like hit them where it hurts in their pocketbook, and that's of an economic nature, and also public pressure, like it's basic organizing. I mean, yeah, more anarchists should do basic organizing and get out there and talk to people. But if you view, it doesn't take that many people to disrupt a welfare office. Like if you view it as a tool for organizing these direct actions, they don't have to be mass sort of demonstrations, but 15 or 20 people. And then it's same in workplaces. If you gather people together with the grievances and where the injustice arises and organize on that, you know, shop floor or location or city or corner or wherever it is, you can really win stuff. Basically, I just say this, we fight with dignity and strength in order to win. That's very important. I guess a lot of solidarity, too, that we've done with folks, we're working with folks at Kanasatake and at Tandanega, has taught us the importance of dignity and in your solidarity or in your resistance of demanding that respect. And when you don't get it, it's really a basis for organizing, because people can relate to that and can see that. We were working with in downtown Toronto. Here's one example of how direct action gets the goods. The movie companies come in all the time and they take over whole corners, whole streets. And Hollywood North is what Toronto sometimes called. So it's a big industry, lots of money coming in. And they displace everybody on the street and they give money, kickbacks or whatever it is. Like, it's not kickbacks, is a gross term, but they give the incentives for the businesses in the area that their movie is going to be here displacing their regular foot traffic. So we'll give you, you know, $100, $200 a day. Yeah. And they displaced all the prostitutes, and they said, "Ha, fuck you. We're not going to do anything for you. Get lost or give us tax receipts." So the women came to OCAP, and we weren't too far away, so we said, okay, they're $150,000 a day or whatever, like thousands of dollars per hour production cost. So if we stop their production, that will get their attention. And so we marched 30 people over with these women. And we said, look, you're disrupting their business. You give everybody else on this corner a cut. These women have had no business for 3 days because of this movie. You should pay them. This is their corner. You should pay them too. And some big actor came out, Ed Harris came out or something as well, and he was like, I understand your concerns. But it got the movie company's attention, and an envelope, an unmarked envelope with $600 cash appeared in the OCAP office the next day. So the women got their money too. So I think there's countless cases like that, which maybe aren't so glamorous of movie stars, but where you go to the boss and you say, look, we're going to disrupt economic disruption, hit you where it hurts, and until we get what we want and what we came for, and it works, you know. And that's I think a basic anarchist principle is direct action. It's nonpartisan. It's a different way, I think, of organizing than a lot of sort of left groups may approach it. If you hear people, the way they would laugh at like the NDP proposing some strategy forward, I mean, you can see that people are really interested in justice and in dignity, and as like I said, and winning, fighting to win, and they're not going to be diverted with lesser ideologies. 'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We march together.
Anti-poverty groups all over Canada have participated in squatting movements as a response to the desperate and unanswered need for basic shelter in many urban areas. The goals of squatting movements are twofold. First, they are a tangible way to protest the injustice of a system where private property is protected even when it is not being used by the owner. While people sleep on the street, abandoned buildings are fenced off in the name of property rights. Second, they are a way to construct alternative institutions and ways of self-management that address the unanswered needs of a community.
In Ottawa, the province of Ontario, the streets are now reclaimed, ladies and gentlemen. There's no cars on it. The police are not doing anything, and we don't know what's going to happen.
In June of 2002, the G8 summit was hosted in Kananaskis, Alberta. 2 days of action were organized in Ottawa in solidarity with anti-G8 protests around the world. During the protest, a squat was opened in downtown Ottawa in a house that had been left to rot for 7 years. After 7 days, the squat was shut down by the police. Amy Miller and Mandy Hiscock are 2 of 8 people who are collectively defending themselves against criminal charges related to the squat.
7 Year Squat was an action that we did nearly 2 years ago during the Take the Capitol days of action. What it was a group of people that had occupied an abandoned building in the downtown core of Ottawa that quickly grew to a home for numerous people and got full community support, where people were coming together and trying to create alternative housing. After 7 days, the city decided they weren't going to tolerate us taking over this abandoned building, so they sent in riot cops, and 22 people got arrested. 8 charges got laid, and so 2 years later, we're a collective of 8 people that are going to be self-representing for a superior court case in Ontario that's coming up in the fall.
What we decided to do for the trial is to not use lawyers. So we're working on basically a consensus basis as a collective that kind of dwindled from 22 to 8. So the way that we work now is that we have meetings in various cities because we all live in different places, and we talk about our legal defense and we talk about outreach, fundraising, and all those things. And it is also consensus based while we're in the courtroom. We take a break, we decide on what we're going to say, who's going to say it, who's going to go up to the front to speak. We take turns, and anything that is said is going to be something that's been agreed upon by the collective. And if something comes up that's new that we need to talk about, we call a recess. And then we go back outside and we talk about it and we come back in with our decision. And to date, the judges have been really great about letting us proceed that way. And it's made it so that we always know what everyone's going to say, and it's always a decision that has come from the group. It's been really awesome to actually work that way, because it's so, so different from when you work with a lawyer and half the time you don't even know what they're doing or why they're doing it. It's pretty anarchistically inclined in the way that we organize, and we're going to be able to maintain that throughout the whole trial.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how the organizing of the actual squat went?
Well, it was a small group of people that had opened up the squat, but the moment that it was opened up, the people that had started the squat immediately invited everyone to join them and take part of the process, and there wasn't many decisions made in advance. The idea of how the squat was going to be run or operated, that was going to be totally organic and decided by the people who decided they were going to stay. So the first evening of the squat, there was a meeting, which I actually facilitated, and it was a wonderful meeting, I think, because there was probably about 70 people in this massive room, and we just covered it all, everything that needed to be talked about when you open a squat that first night, on just, do people have food? All right, you know, like, where are people going to sleep? All right, where do people have any special needs? Okay, you know, well, what about tomorrow? Like, urgency and needs, how to get them done. And it lasted, I think, about 5 hours, but everyone participated, you know, like, it was done on consensus, and there was even a few moments where maybe people who hadn't vocally spoken, you know, okay, let's do a quick go around, and like 60 people just like nodding their head and being like, okay, yeah, we're down with this decision. And so every single day there was a collective meeting at dinner time. From these nightly collective meetings, just committees sprung up left, right, and center, and people, right, just got onto tasks immediately. Rooms just started getting transformed. People from flicking paint to just taking out garbage, and food committees, and a library, and security. And I think it was a beautiful example of people dealing with conflicts and every type of situation under the sun when you get random people living together in an abandoned house, and problem solving in what I think is a pretty positive way.
Can you talk a little bit about where you are right now in the trial process?
Well, we've got all of our trial dates set. So we're going to start off the very last day of September, running into the first week of August. For a whole week, we're going to do our constitutional motions. Those would be the motions where we say, look, you know, what we're doing wasn't illegal. We were protected by the Constitution, and therefore we shouldn't even be going ahead with this trial, or at least we shouldn't have been charged with some of these charges, and some of these charges should be dropped. That's an issue for the judge alone. And so we'll be speaking only to the judge. And at the end of that week, the judge will be deciding if or how to proceed with the trial. And then we have 4 weeks that are set for the last week of September and the first 3 of October. And then we have jury selection, because it's a jury trial. Where we're at right now in terms of our organization for it is we're just basically working on getting outreach, getting support. The courtroom is huge, so if we're going to have people in the courtroom, we really need to do a lot of outreach. And we're basically preparing our legal arguments. We're talking about expert witnesses and who we're going to ask to come in. Yeah, so I expect the next few months are going to be a lot of work, but we have a pretty clear idea of where we're going and of when things are going to happen.
What can people do in solidarity with you?
Well, obviously we need money, but probably more importantly, we really need people to show that they're interested in the trial, that the trial is a concern to them. And I think that one really awesome way to do that, if people are able, is to actually come out to the trial and just sit in the courtroom, so that when the jury looks around, they can see that, you know, it's not just the 8 of us against the state, that it's actually something that the public has an interest in and is going to be interested in the outcome, and that they're going to be held accountable not just to the 8 of us, but to everybody in the room. Also, any just little things like people who may have evidence that we can use, people who have pictures, people who have video, people who saw things who would possibly be witnesses. It would be really good for those people to come forward. And then also just any letters of support, things like that. That I think that trials can be pretty, well, they will be really tough on everybody involved. It's a really long time when people are going to be in a city that we don't all live in. We're not working. We're going to be in trial every day, 9 to 5 or whatever. So any kind of support that people can show, just to show that, you know, they care about what's happening.
We actually have a listserv for people that want to know about our legal updates and our squat-related news. And if they want to subscribe to it, it's 7YRSQUAT, so 7 year squat, /friends@resist.ca.
Pointe-Saint-Charles is a neighborhood in Montreal, Quebec, where the citizens are playing an active role in the political management of their community. Anna Krasinski lives in Point St. Charles. We spoke with her about her work as a community organizer and the application of direct democracy in her neighborhood.
We're working to set up anarchist collective in Point St. Charles, whose objective would be to do political education and to actually put anarchist ideas into practice in a neighborhood.
What is it about the society of Point St. Charles that makes it an ideal setting for the application of these theories?
Well, Port St. Charles has historically been sort of the bastion of innovation in terms of people-run organizations and social movements. Historically, it was in the late 60s that in Point St. Charles was born the first People's Clinic, which has now become the Point St. Charles Community Clinic that I was talking about a few moments ago. It was the place where the first legal aid services were set up, which were also called the People's Legal Aid Services, before the state-run services were set up. It was the first places where people started organizing around food security. It was the first place where people started organizing around adult popular education. And all of these organizations, which were set up in the late 60s, early 70s, were set up with the idea of people power, so of controlling your own services, controlling your own education, controlling your own economy. And this is why I think it's a great place to apply anarchist principles to the organizing, because it's also the place where there's the most social housing in Canada, very high percentage of cooperative housing. So I think that a lot of people already have in their traditions and in their ways of functioning the mutual aid, the talking to your neighbor, the idea also that it's a neighborhood where people hang out on the streets. You know, people sit on their balconies, people sit on their stoop, people know each other. It's kind of an urban village. It's historically sort of been that kind of place. It's physically cut off from Montreal by the river, by the highways, by the train tracks. You go there and you kind of feel like you're in a village. So that's, it's easier to organize, do anarchist organizing in smaller places, places where people know each other and where people have already set up, have already sort of a culture of cooperation and mutual aid.
I'm curious to know, in the context of all of that, what initiatives, what innovations, what are you innovating in that community exactly right now? Not now as we speak, but now in general, over the months and the weeks, today.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's kind of interesting is that Marcel Sévigny, who is a municipal councillor for 15 years in Point St. Charles, an independent, he's always been an anarchist. Well, I don't know about always, but he's been an anarchist for 20, 30 years. He attempted municipal politics, and he was one of the first, because historically in Point St. Charles, the politicians were the local elite. So they owned the businesses, they owned the housing, they were the aldermen at the church, they were on the board of the Caisse Populaire, they ran the place. It was sort of that kind of concept, which is also brings to mind sort of village kind of functioning. But in the 60s, with the people power, there was this sort of class analysis around it. And what's interesting is that Marcel Sévigny, he was one of the first councillors, municipal councillors, who was not part of the local elite. He was elected through neighborhood organizing, door knocking. He had the support of the community. And he was in power for 15 years. He was very accountable to the neighborhood. But when there was the forced demergers, if you want, he quit municipal politics. He felt that as an anarchist, it was not taking him where he wanted to go. And with him, now, myself, I come from the anti-globalization movement. I've been involved for 5 years. I was there in the beginning at 97, 98, and have experienced affinity group organizing, non-hierarchical organizing, and have a real affinity for small group, direct democracy, and federations of affinity groups. And it has taken me, through discussions with Marcel, who has a lot more analysis than me on anarchism and anarchist organizing, has taken me to a level where now I see limits in terms of large social movement organizing, in terms of being able to actually create an alternative to the society in which we live, which is based on relations of domination and subordination. So how do we construct a new society? And I'm there now, so I'm in my neighborhood, and I'm thinking about how, with Marcel Sévigny, about how we can create an alternative from the grassroots, so from the bottom up. And so what we're doing is we have this project, which is really, really very new. I mean, we haven't even launched it yet, but we're We've been thinking about it, and we're actually inspired by examples of neighborhoods and even villages and cities, small cities in Italy or different places where they've constructed parallel political structures to give people the space to actually have debates on the public floor, so la place publique. So we're inspired by that, and we're interested in trying it out in Pointe Saint-Charles. So what we're doing is that we have a project of making one of the streets into a green space, because it's an urban neighborhood with very little green space. So the idea would be to organize with the people who live on that street to create a space where you want to hang out outside, but so slow down traffic, encourage people to use their bikes, bring in ecology also into dynamic. And at the same time, so that we have a project. That project's already underway, actually, because we already have a plan and things like that. The idea being that we would then use the municipal structures that exist, because when they decentralized, they also transferred money, right? So there's like some $50 million available in the southwest of Montreal that's now being distributed by these three marionettes, these three puppets who sit in front of you at the Conseil d'arrondissement, who make decisions amongst themselves while all of us sit in the room looking at them. We have half an hour at the beginning to, ask questions, but really there's not much going on. So the idea being that we would, at the same time, attempt to democratize that space. So we would, for example, attempt to bring in our project in question period for now, for the project of the green space on Island Street. And then when that won't work, obviously it won't work, they're not going to accept that. So then, you start organizing people to come in mass to the meetings. Eventually you make actual official proposals through the channels that you have to do. Eventually perhaps use opportunities to actually use referendums. So you can, if you organize, get money attributed to a project if you do a referendum, because now there is a possibility at the municipal structure for citizen-run referendums. People don't know this. And the idea also that we would eventually perhaps take over the meetings. For example, we are the citizens of Pointe Saint-Charles. This has now become a direct democracy. It's a public assembly where we are going to decide, and the three puppets up front, you can participate with us because you're also citizens of our neighborhoods, and we're going to decide. And I think it's going to be quite shocking for people to see ordinary folks from Pointe Saint-Charles with their kids and with their, older people, younger people, different people who have been involved historically in all these groups, because there's a very strong involvement in different groups, to come to these public assemblies and to take on the municipal structure in this way. And we hope to transform power in the neighborhood. And in parallel, these are just, dreams, but, you can imagine a neighborhood where you would have more cooperatives, for example. Like currently there are two cooperatives on Center Street, which is the main artery. There's an activist cafe and also a coffee shop that's run by young mothers. They're both cooperatives. And eventually perhaps even the laundromat. Now, why don't we have a cooperative laundromat? Why wouldn't we have a cooperative cinema? Eventually maybe we could set up a local exchange system on Center Street where the different commerces would use, for example, Pointe Saint-Charles hours like they do in Ithaca, and have political analysis about money, and also through the co-ops that people live in, take the analysis further than simply, I have an apartment, I have cheap rent. So take it further to what does it mean to actually have housing that belongs to the commons.
The tragedy of modern war is not so much that the young men die, but that they die fighting each other instead of their real enemies back home in the capitals. Edward Abbey.
Anarchism is really a synonym for socialism. The anarchist is really a socialist who opposes the exploitation of man by man. Daniel Guérin.
If God really existed, it would be necessary to abolish him. Mikhail Bakunin. This concludes our four-part documentary series, Anarchism, Freedom on the Air.
Liberty without socialism is privilege and injustice. Socialism without liberty is slavery and brutality. Mikhail Bakunin.
Anarchism is not a romantic fable, but the hard-headed realization based on 500 years of experience that we cannot entrust the management of our lives to kings, priests, politicians, generals, and county commissioners. Edward Abbey.
House people, everything that ordinary people do. And anarchists are ordinary.